Hi, this is Rabbi Eric Levy. I'm pleased to bring to you the second Aliyah, the second of seven sections on the Parsha of Miketz. The second Aliyah begins in Genesis chapter 51, verse 15. Vayomer paro el Yosef chalom chalamti ufoter ein oto v'ani shamati alecha lemor tishma chalom liftor oto. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, I dreamed a dream, but nobody can interpret it. But I heard it said about you that you could understand dreams to interpret them, meaning well enough, that is, you have full comprehension of them in order to interpret them. The word tishma doesn't just mean to listen, but it means to have a comprehension of. Vayan Yosef et paro lemor, bil adai, Elohim ya'ane et shalom paro. And Joseph answered Pharaoh saying, in spite of me, meaning I don't do it on my own, rather God will make Pharaoh's well-being found. I'm translating ya'ane based on Eben Ezra, meaning not so much just to answer paro, but as to make the solution available, to make things found or available. Although the two are very similar in this context, that is, God is answering Pharaoh's unasked questions about what will be in the near future regarding his country. Yesterday I mentioned that the Egyptians are helpless to interpret this dream because it is not in their worldview, or maybe I should say in their heaven view, their God view, that any God, intends to help humanity. That is, their view of God is an antagonistic view, and one pays off the God with sacrifices just to keep them off your back, but one never really conceives that the gods are there to help human beings. Joseph here is saying God wants Pharaoh, God wants you to know the future in order to help you, in order for you to be bishalom, and that's what he means, yaned shalom paro. So that is why God has given Joseph the ability to interpret dreams. And that's what he's saying. Biladai means he's not doing it for my sake and I don't have any innate reason to understand dreams. God wants you to know what the dream is. So I am God's tool to make sure that you get the answers that God wanted to give you. Nachama Leibowitz points out, the great, great Nachama Leibowitz, commentator on the Bible and on Torah, she points out that Joseph is using God's name over and over in this section, both in the previous Aliyah and this Aliyah. And this fits in with my idea, which I evolved from Rabbi Yaakov Maidan and what he taught me, that Joseph needs to and wants to educate Egypt on the way of the one true God. Now, he's not a proselytizer. He's not trying to convey Abrahamic law to override the Egyptian polytheism, but he wants to show people how God works, and therefore he uses God's name over and over again, and he's proud to use God's name over and over again. And that brings me actually to another side point, a historical point, regarding Imhotep IV, also known as Ikhnatan, or Akhenaten, who was the last significant ruler, the pharaoh of the 18th dynasty, which has all the Tutankhamuns and all the Amenhoteps. The year for this ruler, Imhotep IV, also known as Ikhnatan, was about 1375 BCE to 1350 BCE, about 100 years before the Exodus, which puts that famous king, Amenhotep IV, right smack in the middle of Joseph, right in between the time of Joseph, which is probably about 150 years before he came to power, and Moses at 100 years after he died. Now this Ikhnatan was the one who famously worshipped a single god known as the Aten, or the sun disk. If you go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, you'll find all kinds of stones where images of Ikhnatan worshipping the sun disk, and the sun disk stretching out its hands down to Ikhnatan to help him. It's all there, very carefully laid out. Ikhnatan is also famous for his famous wife, Nefertiti, but that's a separate subject. So many scholars, and these are the scholars who generally revel in their desperate attempts to show that Abraham and the Israelites did not invent a new religion at all. They simply ripped off other people's religions or modified other people's religions, and they want to point out that this Amenhotep IV, this Ikhnatan, was really the first monotheist, and the Jews stole it sometime later. Now, besides the fact that monotheism is not just about a single, that is not just about whether you believe in one God or many gods, but it's about the omniscience of God, the omnipotence of God, the fact that God is non-corporal, the way that God forges a relationship and loves his people and holds them responsible and how he's active in the world, that is monotheism doesn't just mean I worship a single God. It means what kind of God do you worship? Who is that single God? But even if there was no difference between the one Aten and the one Hebrew God, which I assure you there is, the influence is completely wrong. Joseph, who lived 100 years before this Amenhotep IV, no doubt had a profound effect on Egypt. That is, the way we're reading this story now, Joseph opens his mouth, he's not abashed at his monotheistic approach, at his Abrahamic religion of his great-grandfather, and he says whatever he can, this is what God wants, this is what the God wants, this is how God works with people, this is why God wants to help people. So it's impossible to prove anything because there's no historical reference. I can't prove that it's Joseph whose religion would be adapted by the Aten cult and by Amenhotep IV, who then converted it into, to be palatable to the Egyptian audience. I can't prove that. And I'm sure a scholar would want to say, no, it's the other way. It's Amenhotep who managed to direct Jewish thought at a later time. But simply based on the histories and based on when these people lived, to my mind, it's quite clear that Joseph brought monotheism into Egypt and Egyptians adopted it to some point. It's not surprising also that this Hebrew idea would be rejected so thoroughly after Ikhnatan's time. Ikhnatan, Amenhotep IV, led this revolution. He actually had to move to a new place, a new city, a new capital city, which he built for the sun disk. But his religion barely lasted out his own lifetime. Once he died, his successors, actually, his major successor, tore down the city and turned all of the stones which commemorated the sun disk as well as this king, Amenhotep IV, and used it for masonry, essentially in an attempt to wipe out Ikhnatan. And it was successful to some point. The point was to stamp out Ikhnatan's name, Amenhotep IV's name, because of his sacrilegious religion, which would even conceive of a single god which has no animal or human form but is just the sun disk itself. Again, there's no way I could prove that that is Joseph's effect on Egyptian culture, but if I simply read the Torah and believe it, which I do, and then I look at Egyptian history and understand what they have, it seems quite clear that's what's being said here. Joseph came not to proselytize, but to make sure that everybody knew who his God was and what his God was all about, and he was going to teach about it, and whether you accept it or not was up to you, but don't be surprised that it did affect Egyptian culture, at least for a short while, before they went back to pantheism. Now, for the next few verses, Pharaoh repeats the dream that he dreams with a few variations and a few embellishments. That is, the dreams of the cows and the dreams of the ears of corn. So, since it's essentially mostly word for word, and I've already translated that in the previous Aliyah yesterday, so I'll just focus on the places where Pharaoh changes or deviates a little bit from what was first told to us and mention why that is true. Vayidaber Paro el Yosef, and Paro spoke to Yosef, Bachalomi hinini omeid al sifata ya'or, Vihine min ayor olot sheva parot briot basar vifotoar vatirena ba'achu. Pretty much word for word. Vihine sheva parot achirot olot achrehen dalot viraot toar ma'od virakot basar lo ra'iti kahina b'chol eretz mitzrayim la roa. Pharaoh uses the word dalot as opposed to dakot to describe the emaciated cows, but the meaning is the same, thin, emaciated. He also says that their appearance is ram me'od, very bad, and he adds on a personal level, I have never seen their like in badness in all the land of Egypt. Lo ra'iti kahena b'chol eretz Mitzrayim, and of course those are his own two cents, not really the dream itself. And again, a small change. Now, the word dakot, first it was changed to dalot, and now it's changed to rakot. It's as if Pharaoh is kind of choking mentally on the image of the sickly cow, where he changes dakot to dalot, and then rakot. And it could be the reason for these changes is and I want to emphasize that here, that we're not just talking about skinny here. We're not just talking about a bunch of skinny cows, like Weight Watchers cows. We're talking about cows with sickly disease, ones that look like walking cow skeletons, that look nightmarishly bad, as would be appropriate for a nightmare. If you want to, you can Google emaciated cows, and you'll probably find some images which are disturbing to you, so certainly they were disturbing to Pharaoh in his time. Vatavona el kirbena velo no da kivau el kirbena umarihemra kasher batchila vakitz. Pharaoh describes it as being consumed by one another. They entered inside of him, that is the fat ones entered into the skinny ones, but that it was indeterminable, that is, after it was consumed, the sickly ones looked just as sickly. And then Pharaoh says, I awoke. And now he goes on to the second dream. Va'ire ba'chalomi v'hinei sheva shibolim olot b'kane echad mleot v'tovot v'hinei sheva shibolim tsinumot dakot shdufot kadim tsomchot achreihem. Pharaoh adds the description tsinumot, which Rashi says, based on the Aramaic, means dried out like a stone. V'tivlana hashibolim adakot sheva shibolim atovot v'omar lachartumim v'ein magidli. Here, Pharaoh doesn't mention waking up a second time, as it does in the first recounting of the story. He just kind of jumps right to where he tells the magicians of the dreams and the fact that none can interpret it, which is really one of the things that's bothering him. So he kind of skips the, what happened from 3 o'clock in the morning to 5 o'clock when he woke up. And now we get to the solution of the dreams. And Yosef has his speech. Vayomer Yosef el Paro, chalom Paro echad hu, et asher Elohim oseh higid et asher es Elohim. Vayomer Yosef el Paro, chalom Paro echad hu, et asher ha Elohim oseh higid lifaro. And Joseph said to Pharaoh, Pharaoh's dream is one, meaning both dreams have the same interpretation, and its purpose, the purpose of which is for God to tell Pharaoh, that is to tell you, what God intends to do, which means God is going to tell you what is in store in the future, and the reason why you're having this dream is so that God can instruct you and therefore help you with what is the inevitable future that's standing at your door right now. Again, Yosef is in education mode, which is why he uses the word Elohim. God is here to help you. Sheva parot atavot sheva shanim heina, v'sheva shibolim atavot sheva shanim heima chalom echadhu. The seven good cows means 7 years, and the seven good ears of corn mean 7 years. The dream is one, meaning the interpretation of both images is the same. Both cows and ears of corn are referring to the same seven years. Now, it doesn't say whether the years are good or bad yet. That comes later, and the commentaries discuss about whether he didn't know yet, and as he's interpreting, he begins to understand more, or maybe he's just kind of presenting it slowly, so it it's easier for Paro to swallow. V'sheva parot arakot v'haraot ha'olot achrehem sheva shanim heina v'sheva shibolim ha'reikot shidufot ha'kadim yiyu sheva shnei ra'av. Finally, we get to what kind of years they will be. And the seven emaciated cows that come up after them are 7 years, also 7 years, and the seven empty, meaning seedless, with no grain or kernels in them, the ears of wheat, the ones that are blasted from the east wind, means there will be 7 years of famine. Finally, we find out that the bad years, the second set of 7 years, are years of famine. Hu adavar asher dibarti el paro asher ha'elohim oseh hera et paro. And he repeats himself, Joseph does, because Joseph is a teacher. He's a didact. He wants Paro to understand God. This is what I have said to Pharaoh. God is showing Paro what he will do. That is just like I told you before. The reason why it's coming out this way is because God is trying to instruct you. Again, there's a surprise here for Pharaoh, that God is helping Pharaoh. Theologically, it's an essential point that Pharaoh needs to be taught, because at that time in Egypt, they did not conceive of gods in that way. Hine sheva shanim ba'ot Sava gadol b'chol eretz Mitzrayim. And now he goes back to the first 7 years to say, behold, 7 years are coming with great abundance or plenty throughout the land of Egypt. V'kamu sheva shnei ra'av achareihen v'nishkach kol ha-sava Beretz Mitzrayim, Mechila Harav, Et Aretz. But immediately succeeding those 7 years will be 7 years of famine, where throughout the land all the abundance will be forgotten as the famine devastates, destroys, literally the word chila means finishes off the land. Now, note that the sense of the fat cows being eaten by the thin cows and not showing their fatness underneath, the simple explanation of that is that the famine will be so bad that, as it says in this pasuk, all of the plenty will be completely forgotten. Ramban interprets it a different way, which we will get to a little bit later. V'lo yivada sava ba'aretz mipnei arav hahu acharechen. The abundance will be forgotten in the face of the famine after that, meaning after the famine comes, because it will be so severe, nobody will remember the good times, the years of plenty. The word velo yivada, which means it will not be known, is a play on the original dream where Pharaoh, as he described it, said, the emaciated cows consume the healthy ones and velo noda kivau el kirbana. It was not known that they were consumed because you couldn't see that the thin cows got any fatter. So here is essentially Yosef quoting velo noda. He says, you're right, velo yivada, sama be'eretz be'arav. Nobody will remember the plenty because of the severeness, ki kaved hu ma'od, the severity of the famine. V'al hishanot ha'chaloma el paro pa'amayim, ki nachor ha'davar mi'im Elohim, u'memaher Elohim la'asoto. And the reason for the repetition of the dream to Pharaoh two times, so really he's not focusing on the dream, but he's focusing on the technique of delivery that God chose. Now, keep in mind that Joseph asserted that the interpretation is one. And that they're all of the imagery, even though there's two different images, are really getting to the same point. So therefore, he has to explain that why God would send two dreams if the interpretation is only one. So he says that the thing, nachon adavar me'im Elohim, maher Elohim lasoto, the decision that God has decided is ready to go, and God will make it come quickly. Or as we might say in modern colloquial language, it's locked and loaded. The word nachon in modern Hebrew means right or correct. But actually, the word in biblical Hebrew is the nifal or passive form of the verb chaf vav nun, kavan or kun, which in modern Arabic is pronounced kana, which means to be. It's the same as the Hebrew haya. The word haya in Arabic is kana, so we have the word nachon here. So it's also, it is to be in the passive sense, or what God has decided is going to be, which means it's going to come to pass, whether we like it or not. And now Joseph slips comfortably, apparently, from dream interpreter to advisor. Now, where does he get off being so audacious as to be the advisor? So this is what I hinted to before. The Ramban believes that the dream itself instructed him to advise Pharaoh. How is it? That is, God told him that the thin cows ate the fat cows. Now, we saw that, and then thin cows didn't grow any fatter, and that showed how bad the famine was going to be. But Ramban understands that experience of the thin cows eating the fat cows is that during the 7 thin years, the only way those thin cows or the people that they represent, the famine that they represent, can survive is by eating what is left over from the fat cows. Even though they won't get any fatter, at least they'll live. And therefore, God has explained that if you want to survive the thin period, you've got to put away side stuff, so the thin period can eat up the 7 years of plenty. It's very clever. And therefore, the Ramban says, Yosef is essentially instructed to explain that this is the way God thinks you should manage the situation if you want to survive. Personally, I think that Joseph, it doesn't really need an instruction from God in the dream to treat himself as an advisor. He is kind of like an early example of that kind of Jewish tenaciousness that we know. That is, thank God for everything, and everybody recognizes that God is the key to success. But nonetheless, if you want to go right, you hire me for the job. You know, if you really want to know what to do, listen to my advice because I'm going to tell you. You know, it's like that famous story about the rabbi where he has two two little pieces of paper, slips of paper in his pocket. He takes out one and says, I am nothing but dust of the earth. And the other one says, for me, the earth was created. At the same time, being confident of your services, at the same time, being humble to know that they're coming from God. So in a classically Jewish sense, I think that Yosef, even without the Ramban's interpretation, Yosef is simply putting himself out there and saying, listen, I got some advice for you based on this dream. Therefore, Yosef says, let Pharaoh identify a wise and intelligent man, a discerning man, and place him over the land of Egypt. Now, this is a step further, because the question is, he's saying, pick a wise and discerning man. Is Yosef really kind of naively saying, you know, I just need you to hire somebody, that's the way to do it? Or is Yosef sort of hinting at himself that I'm the right man for the job? Is Yosef trying to get a position here? Ya'asef faro v'yafkeid p'kidima al ha'aretz v'chimesh et eretz Mitzrayim b'sheva shneha sava. That let Paro do this and appoint civil servants, overseers, p'kidim, over Egypt, and let them take a fifth of the land of Egypt during these 7 years of plenty. Now, I translated the word chimesh literally, and since it's in PL, it's called the privative sense, to remove something. And what it means is, let me take a fifth or 20% of everything that citizens earn, everything that farmers make. Essentially, 20% tax, which back then was considered quite onerous, even though 20% doesn't even raise an eyebrow based on what we pay today. The word chimesh also is used in Tanakh. There's a sense of taking up arms, preparing for battle, making sure you have enough logistics for battle. And then that is the sense here, because Egypt is really going into battle, albeit a battle with nature and a battle with the Nile River. Vayikbitsu et kol ochel hashanim atovot. Yosef is still giving advice. Hatovot habaot ha'ele v'yitzbru var tachat yad paro. Ochel be'arim v'shamro. And they should gather together all the food during this these good years, and they should store the wheat, the food, in under the hand of Paro, meaning the crown, the government should control it, and food in every city there should be guarded, meaning gather produce from all of the fields, set up an armed government-controlled warehouses in every city. This way, during the famine, the crown can quickly distribute the food to every city, and it could do so at government-controlled prices because it has a monopoly on all the food. Now, you may detect something which I'm sort of hinting at here, which is not so positive. And Rashi, in fact, points out that the food tax was involuntary. They didn't have a choice. And I think, I may be going out on a limb here, but I have to say it because I feel this way a little bit, I think Joseph may be steering Egypt into a path which is fraught with potential abuse. I think that the Torah may be hinting, or maybe even criticizing a little bit, that Joseph is maybe seemingly doing a good thing here, but leading down a very dangerous path based on the governmental structure which he's setting up. And I'll speak more about this at the end of this lesson, or in a few psukim, in a few verses. V'haya ochel lepikadon la'aretz l'sheva shnei ra'av asher tiyena ba'aretz Mitzrayim v'lo tikare ta'aretz ba'ra'av. And the food will be a pikadon, I'll translate that in a little bit, for the land during the 7 years of famine that will be in the land of Egypt, so that the land will not be destroyed, wiped out by the famine. Now let's return to the word pikadon. Pikadon is a little bit challenged here. It can mean something simply stored away or reserved. But there is a definite play on the word pikadon here with the words pikidim, the oversayers, vayafkeid pikidim, and set up or give charge to overseers or to civil servants that will be charged or in control of the grain collection, and they themselves report to a single powerful supervisor. So the word pikadon here, it will be a pikadon, a guarantee, a storage, is playing on the pikadon we have before. The sense may be is that grain will protect and oversee the land of Egypt during dangerous times. But I think that there's something more to those words, vayafkeid p'kidim and pikadon. The word lifkod which is a word which really has multiple meanings. It comes from the word to remember, but it means to assign, to appoint, to select an overseer, to gather together an army. It even means when God will take you to task, vayafkedet otcha, he will remind you of your responsibilities. We have to understand that those two words together, vayafked pkidim, is sort of a trademark of Joseph through his life and afterwards. Specifically, he is very famous for a promise, and you may be familiar with this, that God will remember and save Israel from Egyptian bondage in the future. So Yosef, when he's talking in chapter 50, verse 24, he says, "Ve'Elohim pakod yifkod etchem ve'ale etchem me'aretz azot." And he says, God will surely, surely remember. Notice the double pakod yifkod. And he will take you out of this land. And then in the next verse, it has a slightly different meaning, even though it's the same two words. There's a sense not of God will remember you, but God will remind you of your responsibility, specifically the responsibility of taking my bones out of Egypt. Don't leave me behind. Pakod yifkod Elohim etchem v'ha'alitem et atzmotam yizeh. When God remembers, you remember to take my bones out of Mitzrayim. These words are used again and again during the actual Exodus. They're used in Shmot Gimel, referring to the Exodus. God will remember you, or God has remembered you. God has pakad otcha. They're used in chapter 4. And then in chapter 13, once again, they're used referring to the fact that that the people had to remember to bring Joseph's bones out of Egypt, as if there was a danger that he might somehow be lost in Egypt had they not remembered to take him out, or maybe that they even wouldn't want to take him out. There would be a kind of a friction not to take him out unless he had specifically commanded them to do so. So I'd like to say, based on these connecting words, vayafkei pkidim, vayifkod, pikadon, pakod yifkod, that God is connecting these events of setting up this governmental structure where the government owns everything, taxes all the people, and the people have nowhere to go to but the government. I think that these events are connected to the slavery of the Jewish people. And I wonder, and I cautiously wonder, please feel free to disagree with me, if the Torah, but I wonder if the Torah is not being a bit critical of Joseph, who essentially, as we see, and as we will see, sets up a system of slavery to the Egyptian government. Yosef, the genius, the governmental genius, is inventing a totalitarian system where the government controls every product in the land of Egypt. We'll see people come destitute to Egypt in the next few aliyot. They have nowhere to go, and they must trade away every little piece of land for a morsel of food. In the end of the 7 years, what we will see is that everything is owned by the crown, that every Egyptian who lives in Egypt is essentially a servant to that crown, if not an abject slave. Is it possible that this system, which certainly Joseph meant as well-meaning to save the people of the land, is it possible that this system which Joseph himself created would lead to the fate of Israel's abject slavery, where they had no control over their lives and they couldn't leave the country if they wanted to, and where they were essentially owned by the crown? Did Joseph invent a monster that would wind up turning on his own family? Also, when Joseph suggested that a vizier should be put in charge of this whole system, a man of incredible discernment and intelligence, is it possible that he meant for himself to be master of this entire job? And does that affect the story that will happen when he meets his brother? Now, of course, we shouldn't really criticize Joseph for doing these things. Certainly, he's sitting in prison. Who wouldn't suggest that they should be in charge of any kind of system and structure in order a way to get out of jail? People didn't live in jail very long. It wasn't called the boar, the pit, for nothing. Joseph, without question, has excellent control over finances. One could go back to Potiphar if it wasn't for the false accusations of adultery, and Potiphar would have admitted that everything he put in control of Joseph's house, and Joseph made him a rich man, and he trusted Joseph with everything. So is there a criticism here? Is there a sense that Joseph is inadvertently setting up a governmental system which will come back to bite him because he becomes too enthralled with the idea of becoming a powerful man in Egypt and part of Egyptian culture? It's possible. I want to raise the idea. If you look at many Mephoshim, that is the reason why they stay away from the idea that Joseph is really giving advice. And they stay away from the idea that Joseph could be referring to himself when he says, Pharaoh pick a man to be in control of these things, because they do not want Joseph associated with the kind of things that they do not want him associated with somebody who's interested in power and wants to be in control of things. Nonetheless, the text is the text, and I simply want to raise it as a possibility. In any event, let's return back to the Perek, to the Aliyah. Vayitav adavar b'nei Pharaoh v'nei kol avadav. The idea met with Pharaoh's approval, and in fact, with the approval of all his servants. Vayomer paro al avadav, hanimtzach hazeh ish asher ruach Elohim bo. And Pharaoh says, not unpredictably, to his servants, is there anyone like this one, like Joseph, who has the Spirit of God in him? And here it's quite incredible that Paro is using the word Elohim. Now that doesn't mean he's a instant convert to Abrahamic monotheism. It just means that he starts to appreciate in some way or inculcate in some small way what Joseph has been trying to teach him. As we will see, it is a no-brainer who he will in fact pick in to be in charge of taxing the entire land of Egypt and being in control of all the goods and agriculture, since there is no one as discerning or as wise as Joseph. Joseph said, find the most discerning, the most mevin, and the most chacham man. And Paro will say in the very beginning of next Aliyah, I know of nobody more discerning and more wise than Joseph.